Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the previous week. On today's show, we'll hear segments from all three episodes that aired during this week, starting with...
DEI is paid paternity leave for men. DEI is having breastfeeding stations. DEI is some of the stuff that we do for veterans. Mm-hmm. We like to reduce it to race, and race is just a small part.
Monday's episode with Dr. Kenyani Davis, the chief medical officer at the Community Health Centers of Buffalo. We'll then move on to...
In several areas of Buffalo, because if you aren't someone with the transportation to go to an area where you can get something better, this is where you have to shop.
Yeah.
Wednesday's first conversation with Rachel Laster, a dietitian and the owner of Real Life Dietetics and Consulting. And we'll close with...
I worked in industry cleaning some of the messes that these people, our forebears, made. It was a chemical cleaning company, and I had to dress up in all this gear to clean these pipes and these tanks. And I knew, you know, I'm sitting here like, I can't work on this. I can't be in this to do this the rest of my life. I just can't do this.
Wednesday's second conversation with Jay Carrier, an artist from Niagara Falls. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit Naila Ansari's conversation with Dr. Kenyani Davis, the chief medical officer at the Community Health Centers of Buffalo. The two discuss the impact of federal budget cuts on healthcare equity and the broader implications of federal policies on healthcare access and outcomes, particularly for marginalized communities.
Is this where I put that whole disclaimer, this is my medical opinion?
Yes.
That's where I do this, right, so I can keep my job? I think to answer that question, the very first thing is to understand exactly what is Medicaid and what is Medicare. Mm-hmm. The truth is the CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, is the largest purchaser of insurance in America. Everybody thinks that we don't have this socialized system, but the truth is almost over 80% of it is purchased by CMS. So now let's take in, and I believe it was Lyndon B. Johnson who actually put in for Medicaid, and it runs around what we established our government on, which is give us your sick, give us your poor. We'll take care of them. Medicaid is actually a joint venture between the federal government and the state government. So the feds put up money and then the states match that money, and they put up money as well. And that in return, that joint venture creates Medicaid. Medicare, however, is fully funded by the federal government. So when you talk about these executive orders and they talk about cutting in CMS and different things like that, they've definitely voiced that they're not going to touch the Medicare part of it. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, whatever day and time it is right now, I could leave the studio and it could be something different.
Right.
To date, there was no knowledge of actually changing anything with Medicare. Remember, Medicare is 65 and over, or if you have some type of disability, people who have end-stage renal disease, who are on dialysis, even if they're not 65, they can be on Medicare. But Medicaid has always been one of those things that people have always wanted to try and change or improve, if some people say, or, you know, dismantle, others may say. But Medicaid is really at the big forefront of this executive order. And the state in which you live in is very important, because mm-hmm. how they support Medicaid is an important thing, because those are people who people always think it's people who don't work. Right. Sometimes it can be the working poor, people mm-hmm. who just can't afford. So when they did the expansion for Medicaid, under Obamacare, they expanded it to the working poor so that they could have insurance. Then when they wanted to repeal that, it left this large population of people, millions of people who didn't necessarily qualify for Medicaid, right? But they weren't rich enough to pay for insurance. So we call it an essential plan. So these were these people who were kind of stuck in the middle. And that's the working poor. And that's what a lot of Americans fall under when it comes to their insurance. And these executive orders have really, they've really attacked that.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because we all don't know that. Like, I'm just now learning that states are involved in Medicaid.
Yeah,
in particular. So your state also matters.
Your state
in
matters.
Terms of your health care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who loses this coverage first? Because like you said, we assume that it's a certain demographic of people, but it affects a lot of us.
It does. I mean, only this administration knows how they want to roll this out. But I can tell you who loses everybody, right? Because here's the thing. When you don't cover people, it eventually gets to you, no matter how you want to look at it, how you want to slice the pie. When you don't take care of your sick, you're hungry, you're poor, it eventually comes around. To be honest, we honestly don't know who it's going to be. I mean, I will say that, you know, everybody has their speculations, right? I can tell you history has demonstrated sometimes they've tried to put work restrictions on that. And the very first thing is you can't run the country like you run a business, right? I mean, it's very complex. Democracy is very, very complex. But let's say you want to tie work restrictions to Medicaid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to fill out the forms to say that the person can work or they can't work, right? There's going to be a pipeline somewhere where it's going to get clogged at. Who's supposed to do that, right? The healthcare that's already strained, that, you know, already diminished after COVID. Like, you've got to think through some of these things. But my concern is that, honestly, the people who are going to lose, this is the working poor. And I think most people think it's the people who are on the system. No, I think the people who are going to feel it first is the working poor.
And they're going to feel it because we have been doing a lot of work now in this country for preventative health.
Yeah.
What does that look like now that we, you know, folks may not have insurance and they can't go in and say, hey, I'm feeling kind of funky today. Can you help me? And then you find out there's a deeper issue. They might not want to go to the doctor now.
Right. Well, I mean, people don't want to go to the doctors now already, right? especially, for some of us, it's real, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the raids and ICE, some people are a little nervous about coming out of the house and stuff like that, and, you know, and rightfully so. But my concern, though, really with the vaccines is that we've known for years that, you know, vaccines do work, right? There's a whole generation of physicians who wouldn't even know what polio looked like if it hit them in the face, mm-hmm. right? We had a monkeypox outbreak, you know, a small outbreak a few months ago. But I gotta tell you, if you're not currently studying, you know, in school now, I mean, monkeypox is not rocking through your heads, right? Because of all these things that we've done from a really good public health perspective and managing diseases, being able to identify diseases before they even come to the, you know, come here to America. I mean, you think of places like USAID, mm-hmm. right? They have other functions, right? Other functions of keeping diseases away from us or notifying us when things are kind of bubbling up in different areas and preparing the medical community to be able to identify and respond. So it goes a lot deeper than I think some people may think from a public health perspective, but vaccines are a big one. I'm not going to say they're going to be taken from you, right?
Right.
Because I don't know what this administration is going to do. Luckily, you know, we've talked to our vaccine people and they haven't had any communications from, you know, anybody, and they're still going on business as usual, which is always a good thing. But like I said, you don't know. But vaccines, you're getting vaccinated, not necessarily for yourself, but for the person next to you to minimize disease.
It's interesting because this affects public health policies. We got RFK Jr. Mm-hmm. That's now going to be heading up our healthcare systems. And he's been avid that he doesn't really support vaccines, right? And so can you speak a little to that, of the importance of vaccines?
Yeah.
And how do we negotiate someone that's supposed to be our leader telling us one thing who's not a physician versus what physicians that have studied this work for a long time?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I can come out of this booth and it could change. But, you know, we as public consumers of goods, we have a powerful voice. The problem with public health is sometimes you don't want to learn the lesson too late, mm-hmm. right? And we learned that with COVID, right? We kind of learned the lesson a little too late. But we as consumers of healthcare, right, we can still demand, you know, quality. We still need to demand transparency, and we've gotten all that. But we also need to understand the scientific method, right? We don't have all the answers, but every research article that comes out builds upon the knowledge that we have. But this is why I say it's really important that you have your primary care, doctor and you're having these conversations with them, but you absolutely should be asking, you know, your clinician about your vaccine schedule. Are you up to date with your vaccines? Because remember, you're getting vaccinated for the next person, also to protect yourself as well, but you're getting vaccinated for the next person and hopefully to decrease your severity of your diseases. Because keep in mind, each vaccine does something different. Because that's another thing that happens in my office. They're like, oh, well, I got a flu shot and they gave me the flu. No, it didn't. You had the flu before I gave you the shot, right? But the truth is some just decrease severity of disease. Mm-hmm. Some prevent you from having disease. Some prevent the duration of having disease. So I think those are very important concepts to understand, because I think people go into them and then they're like, see, well, I'm not going to get it anymore because I got it anyways. Like, that's not how it works. But now more than ever, you really need to start having conversations about your preventative health, because it may be a very different landscape mm-hmm. next year.
It's so interesting because I think we forget about the whole nation. I think we typically kind of live in our bubble, or vice versa. Some people only focus on the nation and not locally. But what are the consequences that you see for public health equity?
That the less fortunate and even the working class will become really sick. And you got to understand that they make up the majority of the people. You're right. We don't live in a globe. I think this is something that people don't realize, right? We're not the only people in this world, right? So when viruses don't just stay in their one place, they travel, because people travel. And now in 2025, people can travel a lot quicker, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, heck, we're going to the moon now, right? So, I mean, we're probably going to get space aliens in the moon today, right? But because of that, we have to be cognizant not only of what's happening currently in our backyard, but what's also happening adjacent to our, you know, to our partners, to our right and left, as well as on the other side of the world. Because as long as you have trains, planes, and boats that can move people from place to place, nothing can stay in one spot.
And I think that's interesting to kind of dive in a little bit more, because it seems like we are going backwards a little bit, and that we're trying to not push the train forward, and particularly with innovation. And there's a lot of cuts being funded in terms of healthcare and research and medical research and medical advancement. Can you speak a little bit to that and how dire that is for us to not have that research?
Yeah. You know, let me start by saying the system's broken. Right. I don't care who you are, red, yellow, purple, Republican, Democrat. Nobody's going to tell you the system's perfect. The system's broken. The question is how do you define the problem, and how do you start putting the pieces together to try and fix it? We have modernized medicine so much to the point where you can clone sheep now. Mm-hmm. Right. But when you get so specialized in treatments, you can... We were doing things like gene therapy. Like, let's start there, right? And I'm trying to figure out the most diplomatic way to answer this question, right? Rephrase the question again.
In terms of innovation, mm-hmm. with the budget cuts that we're having, say, with NIH and the CDC, it's slowing progress, right? Yes. And what's at stake for the medical research?
Gotcha.
With these reductions.
Gotcha. Everything, right? Because not only are we going to get this very super specific advanced innovations that come out, especially we're doing really cool things with immune systems and cancer research. These are all funded by a lot of times by NIH and different NIH grants. When you do research, there's two particular things to look at. The indirect cost and the direct cost. The direct cost is everything it costs you for the lab and to do the work, which is all really important things. The indirect cost are the things that the institution usually charges the grant to keep everything going. And when we're talking about these grants, we're talking about multi-million dollar grants. One person can't do the work, right? You know, write the grant, do the research. One person can't do that. You need really big structures and organizations to do that if you want to do it the right way. There's things, accountability is in there, transparency. Somebody has to do that. So these indirect costs, they can range anywhere from 10% to 30% of the grant to support the infrastructure needed to do all these really cool things. In the executive order, that was cut, right? Mm-hmm. And it was cut down to 15%. I hear the arguments on both sides. Well, you know, these institutions are making a whole bunch of money off of these grants, right? Others were like, well, listen, it takes a lot in order to, you know, to balance it. I don't know what the right answer is, but I can tell you that a lot of these, we call them R1 schools, which other ones usually know as like Division I schools that are really big on research, is costing them millions. And when I mean millions, I'm talking like $50, $60, $70 million. That gives them pause, because then they have to realign what they're doing. And the only people that suffer is us.
And there was another dig to that too. It's like, if any these research grants that we're going for that were in review process, no DEI, right? So how do you do research without talking about race and gender and sexuality? Like, how does that, how is that possible?
If you don't want to tell the whole story, it's possible, right? Because the truth is that when you start looking at, let's take some medications, for instance. Some medications act a little differently in women than they do men, right? Not necessarily because we're all the way different, but we have different sets of hormones, right? So how does one medication work in this one when estrogen is a little higher, or when testosterone is a little higher? Those are very, very important things. When you, and that's more at a micro level, when you come up to a more macro level and you're looking at just outcomes of diseases or outcomes of procedural outcomes, you absolutely want to stratify it. And you want to stratify it because you want to be able to pinpoint where you can improve. So when you remove that out of the equation, so then how do you know where you're supposed to improve? We all think we're doing really good, right? But the Institute of Medicine report that came in, you know, the early 2000s demonstrated that from the cradle to the grave, that in all possible outcomes, African Americans ended up having worse outcomes from the cradle to the grave. So we know that we've got a lot of work to do. So I will say, in all honesty, rolling some of that back is a disservice to progression. But the other part, I gotta say, not to go off topic, but for DEI, everybody likes to reduce it to race, right?
Correct. DEI, it's so much more than race.
It's a DEI hire. What the hell does that mean, right? But we do this in America. We reduce everything to race,
right?
And that's not it. DEI is paid paternity leave for men. DEI is having breastfeeding stations, you know, for breastfeeding mothers. DEI is having a little more time off of work because you just had a child. Like, none of that is racial, right? DEI is some of the stuff that we do for veterans. So we don't care about veterans, right? We like to reduce it to race, and race is just a small part.
That was Dr. Kenyani Davis, the Chief Medical Officer at the Community Health Centers of Buffalo. We'll now shift over to a conversation with Rachel Laster, a dietitian, nutritionist, and the owner of Real Life Dietetics and Counseling. She sits down with Jillian Hainsworth to discuss the tough issue of limited food resources in Black and brown communities.
That doesn't really change as much as you age, but like, so your need for like water would go down as you age a little bit, your liquid needs, but that doesn't change. So since your protein needs don't change, we really need our elderly members to our elderly, you know, community members to be aware of that and understand that they need to, like, if they're going to be eating, that since their appetite has dwindled, that they should prioritize things that have protein in it. So, you know, meat, like if they must, canned tuna, you know, other types of seafood. We try to ask people to stay away from, you know, what traditionally more cultural dishes in as frequently, not at all, like, but as frequently, like, you know, African-American cultures, we have some dishes that are a little bit more caloric than other things.
Yeah, but they're the best ones.
No, they can be very delicious. and I'm a dietitian that likes to help people understand that all foods do fit.
Yeah.
It's just you have to consider volume and quantity and like frequency. So I like to work with people and have them understand that they can have these things. It's just they might want to consider how much of it they're having, like how often. Like, Thanksgiving is a wonderful meal, but we shouldn't have Thanksgiving dinner 4 days in a row. Like, that's not the greatest way to, you know, like, have long-term effects of health. I very much am a fan of repurposing food. So for our CURLS, which is an organization here that was centered around helping women cancer survivors, I did a Thanksgiving like repurposing of leftovers webinar cooking class. So we took the sweet potato pie, we turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish, or candied yams, and turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish. We took the turkey and just made turkey salad because that was we took the collard greens and turned it to, if you're familiar with callaloo and saltfish, it's a common Caribbean dish. We did a collard green and saltfish type dish, and I also, you can't improve macaroni and cheese. Like, you can't improve it health-wise, so just eat less. Like, it's delicious. Just eat it, enjoy it. And I did something else. I can't remember what it was. But we did, so I like to help people understand that they can take these leftovers and do maybe other things that may be a little healthier with it instead of just eating the natural state.
Yeah.
Fried chicken is fried chicken. I can look, we can talk for hours and hours on the variances of food. However, so fried chicken is good.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't eat a lot of it. Like, there's protein, there's too much fat if you consider the fat content, but we have a lot of people who are, you know, very, like, super interested in veganism or something these days, and they'll still have a fried mushroom.
It's still fried.
Like, so the issue really is the frying, not the content. And if you are someone who maybe is a diabetic or an older person, like I said, we need that protein. And you're not going to find that protein in that mushroom.
Right.
Like, so while this is healthier in a way, it may not be healthier for your needs. And so it's really important to maybe either work with a dietitian or just understand what your needs are so that you can make those choices.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to pivot, but I have one question first.
Please go ahead.
Before we do. Are there such thing as good sugars and bad sugars?
Not really. Like, so all sugar is sugar. Now that's also like we're considering what are your conditions. So if you are, so no, like honey is not better than table sugar unless you are considering the antioxidant content.
Okay.
So if we're if we're focusing on glucose, sugar is sugar. All sugar, like raw sugar, turbinado, brown, you know, like honey,
sugar,
agave, all these, like, all these sugars are sugar. Your body's going to react to it the exact same way. It's going to break it all down to the exact same glucose. Now, there are benefits to honey in a way where it does provide antioxidants. So if that's what your goal is, you want some antioxidants with your sugar, go ahead. That's fine. It's really, you still want to watch the volume of sugar you're using. There's not, this one sugar is not going to be significantly better than another sugar. People are like, you know, I don't have that white table sugar. I just have, I like raw sugar.
Yeah.
It's sugar. Your body has no idea there was a difference. there's no difference. To that point of vegan desserts, I had a friend insist that this vegan cookie was significantly better than another cookie. And I was like, the problem with cookies is not the milk or the egg per se. It would be the sugar content. And so if we're going to have a villain in this situation, it would be the sugar content. And that usually doesn't change. Like Oreos are vegan. I wouldn't call Oreos particularly healthy. Delicious, yes, but not healthy. So you have to consider like what we're being marketed in terms of health and like the buzzwords people are using to make you purchase things that really won't be beneficial in the way you may think they would be.
So we know that Buffalo is really unique. You are very active in the community in like a lot of different ways. You're a part of a lot of different community groups, a lot of community facing work. So in 2022, we know that we had a mass shooting at Tops, the only grocery store in a black community in the city of Buffalo. And
very unfortunate.
It caused for a month the grocery store to shut down, which obviously was a lack of resources. I like to use food apartheid and not food desert because a lot of this is systemic and intentional.
Systemic and intentional, very much so, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I want to ask first how you felt about the efforts to provide the community, especially 14208, with like nutrition and like food resources post May 14th?
Yes. So I actually have to applaud all the organizations that did come together because the nature of that area, like you said, food desert, food apartheid, there is a big issue around that, especially in several areas of Buffalo, because if you aren't someone with the transportation to go to an area where you can get something better, this is where you have to shop.
Yeah.
So in terms of the efforts put forth, and that was a lot of, you know, community different organizations like African Heritage Food Co-op, Feed Buffalo, and several others. If I did not mention you, do not charge it to my head and not my heart. There were so many organizations that did reach out and create an ecosystem over there that unfortunately was not getting the attention it deserved prior. So the food, the nature of food access in Buffalo isn't great. At least to healthy, what we call healthy foods, and I'm thinking in particular fresh produce. We have a lot of people here now doing the work. We have so many organizations that are doing the work to help improve that. Like we have, you know, Buffalo Go Green as well, the organization we mentioned earlier. Providence Farm Collective, MAP. There's so many organizations that are trying to help increase the need, the access to fruits and vegetables in Buffalo. So we have a lot of people doing that work, and that is good. So I'm glad that work is happening. In regards to the shooting and the efforts afterwards, it did sort of, I think, elucidate for a lot of other individuals in the community, though, the need for education around eating healthier, as well as just the lack of access prior. Like, you know, unfortunately, our communities were very much ignored. And, you know, so since they were ignored, we had individuals of the mind to do the work prior. Like, you know, like they were trying to build a market. I love that Truly Rooted Market is where it is over on Fillmore now. That is a beautiful store, as well as Salud over on Main. Like, we have stores that are now much more in that area. And I think also maybe have potentially may have gotten funds for that. I have no idea exactly. But I think it helped show people the need for better access to these vegetables. Vegetables and fruit and, you know, produce in general, and healthy eating in a sense. We also have so many urban gardens. So those individuals help people learn to create their own food. Now, I have no green thumb. I tried. I gave up. Like, so I appreciate them for at least trying to teach and helping people, but also creating even more access. Because at the end of the day, as much as we do just shop at stores most of the time, we can learn to take care of ourselves in a way. And also, there are very few things I say globally as a dietitian that will improve your health. But the only two things I do say are drink more water and eat more vegetables. And so since those are two things that I think are very important and can pretty much apply across the board, access to those things I feel is very important.
So for the people who may not still have access to those things regularly, whether that's because of the location they live in comparison to the closest real grocery store that has fresh produce, or finances, you know, we have a really high population now of people from other countries who may not be eligible for certain social services. What tips can you give people to try to eat more vegetables, drink more water, you know, make healthier choices when they don't necessarily have the same access?
Okay. Well, I mean, there are some food pantries that you can that are supported by, you know, Feed More or other organizations that can provide you with, you know, that have access to fresh fruit and vegetables. I know Harvest House would be one. Provisions 139, that's over on the west side. They would be some food pantries that you could attend, but if you don't have access to those, because once again, that's still a transportation issue, or at least where you are located issue often. So if you don't have money for food, I imagine you don't have a car. I'm assuming you may. I would say, like, there's ways to sort of stretch food. Canned food gets vilified, and it is very salty in comparison, but you can, like, the utilization of canned food, you can, like, rinse vegetables off. And then, like, if you rinse them, you can still use them in soups and things of that nature. If you have fresh fruit and vegetables, I would never throw anything away. What you should do is when you see it starting to maybe get less fun, just freeze it. Like just because you can turn it into soup. Soup is a very easily stretchable food. Our canned beans are a very good source of protein. Our canned vegetables are still a good source of fiber and minerals and all those things that vegetables provide. Just like I said, the preserving methods are salty. So we do ask that if you are using canned vegetables, to try to rinse them like before you utilize them. Mm-hmm. Frozen vegetables, people have asked me, like, are frozen vegetables as good as fresh? Sometimes they're better. You really don't know, because frozen vegetables often get picked and then frozen. So yeah. They retain that nutrient content. When we have our vegetables in store, we don't necessarily know how long they've been, like, how long, where they came from, how long mm-hmm. they were in the truck, how long they got in the storage room, how long they've been out. So they could have essentially lost some more nutrients than your frozen vegetables. And frozen vegetables are often a very cost-efficient method of getting your nutrients in as well. So if you can't afford fresh, but we do we have a lot of stores, we have a lot of efforts, a lot of community efforts to help provide people. I know Saturday Academies are doing the free farmers markets. So there's a lot of efforts around in Buffalo that I'm glad people can access. It's just maybe giving more education around where they are, make sure people know that they exist.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to community awareness is just that when we're such a segregated community,
very.
Unless you are located near the resource, you may not know it exists at all.
You may not know. And so there's probably some more work to be done on that effort to make sure that many years ago, I was like, there needs to be one person in charge of all this to disseminate this information so that people won't be working in silos and people won't be doing, like, at least the nutrition efforts, but to the nature of the work, unfortunately, it's very much grant-led in most cases. And I don't know how you're familiar with grants or not, but it can be, like, it's a lot of duplication of effort because of the nature of the way the work is paid for.
Right.
And so since there's like, oh, the one person's doing this over here, but now it's cut off, and now someone else is over here doing this, and now that's cut off, and now someone over here is doing this. It's very similar, but now that's cut off. And so since the nature of it being grant-led and somewhat confusing, that also I think leads to why people may not be able to know that something's happening. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we could do some better effort and maybe should make sure that people are aware of the beneficial things to them in the community.
Are there any other myths about food and eating that you hear that just like grinds your gears when you hear it?
The water, the alkaline water. Like, you don't need that. So I do like to tell people to save money. Like, I'm very big on teaching recipes and doing community classes. And just when I do those classes, I try to give recipes that are firstly affordable and then lean people away from doing things that aren't to their benefit. So once again, like, you can pay more for water if you'd like, or you could just drink water. Like, there's not going to be any actual science that supports alkaline water being better for you. No shade to Dr. Sebi's diet. It's a perfectly fine diet. However, it is not accurate in the science behind why it would be a good diet. And it's much more restrictive than it needs to be, because some of the things he's saying don't eat, you can perfectly well eat and be fine. That's not how mucus works in your body. that's not conceptually how it works. But if you were to eat and follow that plan, you wouldn't probably find any particular issue with the diet. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not doing what he says it does.
I could talk for days.
Yeah, huh? I could probably, like, prebiotics. If someone's, there's nothing wrong with it. Probiotics are a thing. I would suggest you just buy some yogurt. I wouldn't suggest you pay, like, unless you want to buy something more advanced and you actually know you have a diagnosed issue within your colon that requires more more of a pharmaceutical method of a probiotic, you're probably fine just eating something
but
like
you can
yogurt.
Find a lot of things like, in yeah, food right?
Yeah, you find a lot of things in food. So people talk about prebiotics now, which is just a fancy word for fiber. You don't need to purchase those. Like, so if you're seeing something marketing that to you, you don't need to buy that. You can just eat more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and then you will get more prebiotics in your diet. It's really just truly a fancy word for fiber. We don't need to do a lot of things. Anything that says like keto, just about on it, unless you are someone diabetic and in need of a lower carbohydrate item, you probably don't need to buy that. However, if you're someone that does want to increase their fiber intake, those breads and like those type of products are often higher in lower in carbohydrate and higher in fiber. So you have to look at your labels. Nutrition label reading is super important, and a lot of people just don't do it. And that's where your source of truth, in a sense, is going to be. Now, it can be off by about 20% in either direction legally. Mm-hmm. So, but in most cases, that's just for the sake of, and that's mostly the case of restaurants. Because, you know, if you're scooping food onto something, that's you can't really measure that fully and know exactly what's in there. But in terms of what you're seeing in the market, that number and those things does have to be, that's regulated, you know, that in a sense. Like, so it's important to read your labels because that'll give you what's in your food. And so it gives you that much more information. You know your protein content, you know your fat content is, and you know what your carbohydrate content will be, and protein. And so these things are all important to know, especially if you're trying to do that tracking, especially if you're trying to just do, like, to meet your needs. And that's important for people to do and know. To that point, I feel like there's some things I should say that people should know. So in terms of water intake, I've noticed that some people don't drink enough water. And this is a lot of people, not just some, like, a lot of people don't drink the right amount. They drink some water, and they're like, I've had this one 16-ounce bottle a day. That's not sufficient. You need a minimum 4 16-ounce bottles a day, unless you're, like I said, older. But so you need 64 ounces or so of water a day minimum. And then more than that's good. You don't necessarily need that gallon. Now, that's a lot. That's about two. That's okay. That's more than you would need. But I do like to help people, like, to the point, drink more water, eat more vegetables. To that point as well. So we as dietitians support this thing called, you know, our government thing, My Plate. So we ask people to eat about half a plate of vegetables and fruits, you know, non-starchy. So, and then about a quarter of their plate be carbohydrates. So rice, pasta, starchier vegetables like potatoes, corn, things of that nature. And 1/4 of our plate be protein. About any 3 to 4 ounce item of protein would be about 20 grams of protein. So we say, and by protein, we prefer lean proteins like chicken breast, turkey, just about any seafood. Seafoods are going to be a much lower fat way to get to the same protein goal or protein amount than our meat sources. But if you can't eat any of those or choose not to eat any of those, you can always do things like beans, lentils, tofu, if you're interested in learning to cook that, because a lot of people aren't as familiar with tofu. But those are all plant-based sources of the same protein.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. I just learned so much. I've been doing it wrong, guys. I gotta go home and adjust. But I really appreciate having you, and I hope that we can have you back at some point, because I think these conversations are so crucial in our communities. Before we leave, for people who want your services, who want to learn more, who want to sit down and figure out what they need specifically, how can they find you?
They can find me at Real Life Dietetics, reallifedietconsulting.com, or at they could just give me a call at 716-812-1577.
That was Rachel Laster, a dietitian, nutritionist, and the owner of Real Life Dietetics and Consulting. We'll close out today's show with a conversation Jay Moran had with Jay Carrier, an artist in Niagara Falls. They discuss his latest exhibition, Niagara, It's Great to Be Here, which is on display at the Buffalo Art Studio through April 5th.
Today on What's Next, more of my conversation with artist Jay Carrier. Born on the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve, Jay Carrier has lived most of his life in Niagara Falls. Now, 61 years old, his massive body of mostly abstract work is gaining attention.
My actual real name was given name from my father, and it's Hubert Carrier. Hubert Carrier.
Oh, okay.
That's how you kind of pronounce it in French. But everybody called me Jay when I was very young because nobody liked my father. So my grandfather titled me J.R. It was Junior. And everybody caught on to it just as Jay. But some of my brothers and stuff, they'll call me Hugh or Hubert. And but most of my friends and everything call me Jay.
And let's be honest, the name Jay is...
It flows just a little bit better. That's actually my given name in the longhouse.
I'll print it up here. Yeah.
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 And that's my given name in the longhouse, Dagahatwe. He paddles his canoe.
Oh.
And that's an Onondaga. that was given to from my clan mother. My grandmother was the clan mother of our nation, the Wolf Clan.
You know, it's interesting talking to you. You know, we talked before about growing up here in Niagara Falls, and you're pretty young when you came here.
Yeah. About 3 and a half.
Yeah. So, okay. So, yet you carry your native heritage with you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my mother made sure that would happen.
Yeah.
She was a faith keeper in our nation. She was going to be a clan mother. She wasn't. Her sister was. But she was a very valuable source of, they call it the old ways. And the old ways were the longhouse ways. And she knew all the ceremonies and everything. So she was teaching people the languages. She knew, I believe, 4 languages out of the 6 nations. And she was teaching Onondaga, which was her clan, you know, language.
Jay Carrier spoke reverentially about his mother, her many skills, her ability with native language, and how she journalized daily activities with minute detail.
I've always said that this what I'm doing is my language. It's my own personal language. This is me doing what my mother was doing, but translating it in a visual sense. And being honest about who I am and where I grew up, that I talk about everything, even non-native issues, you know, just human issues sometimes. And of course, human issues transcends, you know, peoples.
A studio overflowing with paintings and drawings, Jay Carrier walks me through some of the works. One particular piece that was painted on wood shelving contained ample personal meaning.
So Leave Us by the River is a reference to my mother bringing us to Niagara Falls and raising us in Niagara Falls away from the reservation. And the fire that grew so low was a reference to the hard times, some of the hard times we had. The reason why we moved here, so we move, because our father was being abusive to our mother, and she wanted to not raise her children in that environment, so we moved. So this was a piece, a kind of somber piece that said we had to move away from this person, and we moved by the river of Niagara Falls, and it wasn't a good experience, the fire that grew so low.
That's
just piece of the story.
Sure.
You could see I was fairly prolific.
Yes.
I'm just sorting through some of these drawings, and I think I'm about a quarter of the way through, and I'm trying to archive them because this gallery in New York told me you better start taking care of your work because it's relevant. Everything that you make is relevant because of the stage it's going on. So I started putting them in these plastic archival sleeves. And I've already done 160. And I think I'm about a quarter of the way through my drawings.
Just drawings. Not the many paintings that I see about here on the walls and leaning up on the walls.
Not the drawings.
Yeah.
And a lot of the work I've made throughout the last 20 years, I would say half of it wasn't even shown, because a lot of the work I make in here, I'll put back there, and it doesn't see the light of day. It just goes back in that whatever. That's why I have so much work. I didn't have time to pursue that that second part of being an artist as far as promoting it, selling it. And I'm not saying that I didn't do shows. I did shows along the way, but it wasn't at it wasn't my occupation, so to speak. I worked in industry in Niagara Falls for the last 25 years, and I finally retired.
Before he retired, Jay Carrier worked in the chemical industry, giving him a keen understanding of the realities of what was being produced, its environmental impact, and how the many industrial facilities provided jobs to the people of Niagara Falls. Even when he was working, Jay Carrier would spend as much time as he could in his studio painting and creating. Saving most of the work may prove of great value as outside interest grows. Jay Carrier's work was recently shown in New York City at the 42nd Canal Gallery, and another exhibition has been showing in recent weeks at the Buffalo Art Studio.
It's about the Niagara River, my interpretation of the Niagara River. Niagara, It's Great to Be Here, was the original small painting. I think it was 24 by 24. It was a smaller piece. Was a self-portrait of me. I worked in industry cleaning some of the messes that these people, our forebears, made. It was a chemical cleaning company, and I had to dress up in all this gear to clean these pipes and these tanks and whatnot. That was my job. And I knew, you know, I'm sitting here like, I can't work on this. I can't be in this, you know, to do this the rest of my life. I just can't do this. And ironically, my wife and I were going down the Robert Moses Parkway, and I realized what was in this plant. I'm not going to name the plant.
Sure.
I realized what was in this plant because I was intimately involved in cleaning some of the places up around it. And it said, there was this big sign on the side of this tank that held some kind of chemical in it. And it said, Niagara, it's great to be here. And I think, how freaking ironic is that?
Oh.
You know, Niagara, it's great to be here. You polluted out half of Niagara Falls. Your company, because you inherited that, doesn't mean it's your, it's still your responsibility and liability. But we know you didn't do it, but you're still responsible for that contamination, Love Canal, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's other places in Niagara Falls that were their responsibility.
Right.
And I thought, how ironic. And I made that painting right after that. And I said, that's incredible that's how they think. That's how they're trying to bamboozle people, thinking that they're doing a good thing. But on the flip side of that, this company employed hundreds of people that raised their families in and around Niagara Falls to sustain their life. You know, they were raising people from these wages and these plants. And when that was taken away, them families moved out of here from Love Canal and from the Niagara Falls area. And I thought, so it works both ways.
Yeah.
But then I worked in a chloralkali place over here on Buffalo Avenue. And, you know, there was still a lot of talk about these chemical factories. And I know personally that they didn't pollute because of the EPA. I knew personally, because if they did, I wouldn't have worked there that long. I worked 21 years. And I come to see the hypocrisy in what people deem as chemicals, because the floors we walk on, the shoes we wear, the foods that we eat, them chemicals that we make are all of that, and it's all about you. So that's hypocrisy. You rely on the clean water that we drink. You rely on so many things that these chemicals are in, and you don't realize it, that's why they make these chemicals, for, you know, the cleanliness of our waterways, the cleanliness of your dish soaps, your everything, laundry detergents, you name it. It's made here, but you just don't know it in its raw form, that it's in these chemicals that you use every day.
And then the other paintings that ended up at the Buffalo Art Studio, I mean, did they fall into that theme, or are you leaving it to the curator to
It weaves in and out of that. It weaves. It's not because the whole show wasn't directly geared towards that idea of the politicalness of the chemicals that exists, excuse me, within our waterways and environment. The idea was that the person that made these pieces lived in the history that you're talking about, intimately in the environment, in the social sphere, the place that you're talking about. This wasn't just on paper. This was a person living through that. So I knew both sides of this. I knew the political side of the Love Canal mess. I knew the cleanup side. So I knew intimately what these plants were and what they did and what we were doing and we inherited all this stuff. I knew the other side of this, where there's a plant in Niagara Falls that I work for that actually were stewards of our environment, and it's a chemical plant. And I said to myself, if you only knew, you know, the beauty of what they did. They cleaned up this place, you know, because of the EPA regulations, of course. But they still, they held to their word that they were not going to pollute Niagara waterways out. And so that would allowed me, you know, the idea that I could continue working for you, because I wouldn't have worked for them if we were doing stuff like that. I would never want to be on the other end of that, the other side of that.
I think you may have kind of answered my final question about the Buffalo Art Studio show. Mm-hmm. When people come to see it, what do you want them, how should they approach it? I mean, I know everybody has their own way of doing it, but it sounds like, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. you've got a history inside these paintings that it seems like it should be known as a viewer's taking a glance at it.
Yeah, it works on many levels because, as I said, I grew up in Niagara Falls. I had a great upbringing, and I knew intimately the rivers. I swam in them. I fished in them. I enjoyed the camaraderie that many of the local people I grew up with enjoyed the rivers, as I did. I looked at it as a place of sanctity, the Niagara Gorge specifically. I looked at it as a place of healing, and I looked at it as a place of enrichment to the whole society that Niagara Falls exists in. It's just that nobody wants to tap into it, and I'm glad they don't, because they leave it alone for the most part, meaning the Niagara Gorge specifically. So I knew it on many different levels, and because it was my history, growing up downtown, of course, I knew the people, and I thought the people were more important than the falls themselves. The people were more important than the rivers, because they lived here and they lived through this stuff. And they know, and I know, that Niagara Falls is a great city. It just has to be, taken care of in a good manner. And I can't say that it's being taken care of in a good manner currently.
On What's Next, we're hearing more of my recent conversation with artist Jay Carrier. After working professionally in industry for most of his adult life while doing art on the side, he is now retired and has more time to devote to his work, and a lot of that is going through the decades of art that he has stockpiled. As we've heard, Jay Carrier is forthcoming not only about his hometown of Niagara Falls, but also about other Indigenous artists and their collective influence on modern art. Here's more with Jay Carrier. This is What's Next.
As, you know, as a contemporary artist, of course, I'm painting in the moment, but I'm reflecting on the history of who I am also. So there's different levels that you could look at these paintings from. You could look at it from a historical place. You could look at it from a compositional place. You could look at it from an emotional place. You could look at it from, you know, I don't like it place, or however you want to look at it. Like, I could talk about this painting for an hour today and come back tomorrow and have a whole different story, because I'm talking from a different place of view. Hmm. So, and I do that because I want the viewer, because many viewers have different, they don't know. They could interpret this any which way they want. So the viewer comes to a painting and they have their own opinions on what they're seeing and what they're looking at, and expressions, and I would like to think that the viewer can interpret it and leave it as an open interpretation of what they're viewing, so that they feel comfortable with what they're doing and what they're interpreting, because it's theirs and theirs personal. And if I could touch a person where it's a personal place that they go to while viewing one of my paintings, then I did my job as an artist. You know, I made an impact on that person. Whether it's negative or positive, it doesn't matter. I still made an impact. And the way I look at these paintings that I do is once they leave me, I'm not going to be around these paintings when they show in these different places. Once they leave me, they still gain a history. So I'm not there to speak about what this is. There's words that go with this, maybe in a introduction to the show, but it's an abstract piece, and it's going to garner a lot of activity, meaning people are going to come to it with different perspectives, and I like to leave that open, and I like to think that the piece itself interprets and internalizes from these viewers as much as they're getting. The piece starts creating its own history. So if this piece goes to 10 different shows, it could be shown with 10 different meanings, and the mythology starts to work in its effect.
I want to return to a conversation we had off mic before, and I thought it was curious. And we were talking about how Indigenous artists, there seems to be, the world of art seems to be opening up in recent times. Mm-hmm. Art isn't new to Indigenous people, but that world of art that is in galleries and in museums seems to be really opening up and connecting with.
Well, I think the whole thing with climate change, I think climate change has cued everybody that, you know, this stuff that we're living in is not permanent, and that we have to maintain and take care of, you know, the natural beauties that we're surrounded by, or we might not have them. Hopefully we will in generations and generations. But the way things are going now in the political climate, we might not have that too much longer. So I think because of that idea that Native people were inherently kind of the custodians of this philosophy of natural beauty, I think it came to more light, especially in the spheres of art. I think that's what happened.
And then finally, I think you dated yourself 61 years old.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can be doing this for decades to come?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I hope so. I hope one of my last days that I exist is in a studio painting. I hope that happens, yeah. I'll forever be doing this. I've done it since I was a little boy, making drawings out of comic book characters in a closet when I was 4 or 5 years old. I remember that, and I have drawings from that. So I hope that, you know, as far back as my memory goes, and as blessed as I was since then, that I could continue doing it right to my final days.
And it seems, I'm following up with my final question with another question, of course, but it seems to me you're very intuitive that you know, the moment comes to you and you follow it, and you've even told me, like, this particular painting here may have been in 5 or 6 different sessions putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
But are there areas that you want to explore that you intentionally want to continue to move toward?
Well, what I don't want to do, I could tell you what I don't want to
okay.
do. I don't want to be pigeonholed into some kind of genre of painting. I don't want to be considered this or that kind of painter. So I leave it open to interpretation. Whether it goes on in my historical legacy, one of these days, it'll be that. That I wasn't just an Indigenous Native American artist, that I was a great artist that was an American.
Jay Carrier, thanks for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's great.
We've been listening to more of my recent conversation with artist Jay Carrier, conducted in his studio in Niagara Falls. Jay Carrier's work is on display right now at an exhibition, Niagara, It's Great to Be Here, at the Buffalo Art Studio at the Tri-Maine Center.
And that will do it for Producers Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Dr. Kenyani Davis, Rachel Laster, and Jay Carrier. If you miss anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is also online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.